The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And in person, actually at my place, so nice, Joel Wilcox, founder and director of Fourth Wall Wines. Joel, thank you so much for doing the podcast.
Matt, thanks so much for having me here. Really appreciate it.
Listen, you came in with just oodles and oodles of goodies. Very excited. Before we talk about your wines and the project, and people go to fourthwallwines.com, let's actually just start with a tasting of a wine I'm sure I should not like, because this is the Riesling that you've poured. What do we have here? And I'm doing it different, just rushing forward and talking about a wine, but we're getting to the entire project.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks. This is the 2019 Riesling. Now, this was made at Ravine Vineyard, sold out now. So Lydia Tomek is the head winemaker there. I love the bracing intensity on this one. This was actually raised in a mercury puncheon. Clone 21B, dry,
yeah.
Like a little RS, but the acid and the pH are just right where you want it to be.
There is nothing. Anyone who is afraid of sweetness, this is a Riesling for you. Bracing is absolutely right. This is a serious Riesling. You know, there's just the nice, simple, and I don't mean this in a bad way, delicate, some orange going on Rieslings. Easy to drink, pairs with everything. This one is a lot more intense. Oh yeah, this is a good wine. This is a good start. All right, so as I nose through this and take another sip, let's just start here. If you a nano batch wine project focused on premium Ontario VQA bottlings. Joel, what is Fourth Wall Wines?
I'm from Niagara on the Lake. I grew up in the '80s in Niagara while everything was sort of starting. I mean,
right.
You know that we've come from a very far distance from where Ontario wine was back in the early 70s that I just hear stories about and see pictures of. And I think you can still find Baby Duck on the shelf, but again, that's, again, distant memory. My thinking was, if I can make wine and have it available in Ontario, I don't necessarily have to have my name on it, and I don't have a property of my own to name after. I mean, if you go to classical global regions, they're named after zones, they're named after people, founded castles, and so forth. And we don't have that. One of the more important ideas with wine tasting that I always felt was the personal experience that you get when you taste the wine. To kind of get into like a nerdy bit here, you know, my background was English literature. I appreciate film and theater. But I have to say that when you drink wine, that's interpretation. So how you describe it, your own gift to the wine. And so if you're breaking the fourth wall in film and theater, you're stopping your dialogue, you're talking to the audience. Wines that speak to you, that's sort of what we're getting at here.
Intense orange, a little bit of apricot, tiny bit of tropical. The acidity on this wine is I might go somewhere in Germany on the first tasting of this. This is great. So this is your 2019 Fourth Wall Wines Riesling from 4 Mile Creek. This is a really good wine.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, and by the way, I have a theater background myself, so I totally appreciated. I totally appreciate when it's called Fourth Wall Wines. There are a lot of people. Well, not a lot, but there are people that do this. That they make wines. They have relationships with wine growers, winemakers. Because let's face it, the price of a vineyard now, a vineyard space now, versus, say, even the early 2000s, it's, you know, we talk about how expensive it is to rent in downtown Toronto, and we would see similar sort of leaps and bounds where you are.
Yeah. And, you know, this is kind of diving into some good territory as we're, I've heard your podcast many, many times. We have great conversations with some vineyard owners and winemakers, and the thing that you've spoken about, I believe, the novelty of it all. You know, you're paying for grapes every year, you're paying for labor,
yep.
But you're paying for the land too. And a lot of these first generation owners, we have to factor that in. So if, you know, is an Ontario wine more expensive than, you know, a $10, $12 Chilean example? Well, yeah, but there's also, there isn't the history that follows through with it too. So yeah, it's, that's sort of where we, by working with different properties, we can sort of find the best examples, find cool small site offerings, and emphasize site, place, and character more so than a generic wine.
And we'll get into all the relationships you have with that, because a lot of the wines, you're partnered up with some very well-known and respected wine producers across Niagara. Let's go back to 2007. How did this all get started?
Oh, just me cleaning a tank.
What were you doing in 07? What was your job?
So this would have been after grad school. I'd been working at Riverview Cellars previously, prior to university, and kind of going back in there, helping in a variety of ways. And just thinking, I'd love to do something, my own project. What would it be? What would it be? What would it be? And then the idea of, you know, Fourth Wall Wines kind of came in, just as a name and in concept. Mm-hmm. Had a design for all the different, you know, what would we have and so forth. But the idea of working with other folks came later. That came back actually in the Canoe era.
What was? Let's do sort of a LinkedIn game. What was your path? From, you know, you were talking before about like cleaning dishes and or cleaning stemware. How did you get from, you know, polishing wine glasses in Niagara on the lake to now here with Fourth Wall?
When I it would have been, I guess, what, 2011 or so, when I started working at Canoe Restaurant. Will Preedom, the senior sommelier at the time, took me on. We had met previously through some friends in Niagara. He was generous enough to bring me in, and it was just as a server assistant, just getting in the back, getting your hands dirty, and then worked my way into the wine program there. So in 2014 or so, left that position. So we had a few years at Canoe. I'd already known a lot of people in Niagara, but you meet a lot more when you're in that kind of a job. And joined up with Woodman Wines and Spirits, which I'm with right now. That's you know, some great folks there. And this little project, I mean, this is small potatoes, all things considered. This is, you know, creative, you know, that kind of was always kind of bubbling in the back of my head. So before the pandemic, I thought, well, you know, you're getting older. If you're ever going to have some wine, you might as well start now. And there was no sign of COVID at the time. It was just, let's kind of move on it, right?
Right.
But the wheels started, and just literally by talking to some folks, you know, I had a nice drink and dinner with my friend Mike, GM at Riverview, said, you know, introduced. He said, how can I help, you know? And so all of a sudden, it's not just Mike, it's Marty over at Ravine, because Marty was over there at the time. And all of a sudden, you're talking with other folks, and it's just, you know how it is. A small town community, you get together and yeah.
But that also speaks to just the generous nature of the community. Yeah. I would imagine the Joel, the version of you in Burgundy, it might be a little bit harder to get everyone on board to help you out with this versus in Niagara.
I've never heard of that ever happening in any circumstance ever before.
Yeah, but, exactly. Yeah. This is the next thing is a Sauvignon Blanc. What's the story behind this fella?
So it was literally, you know, when back, you know, 2018 or 2019. Sorry, it wouldn't have been 2018, of course. So this would have been shortly after harvest in 19. And again, originally coming in with Marty and Lydia, we were just looking through, tasting some stuff, and this, you could really, this is great. Try this Sauvignon Blanc. See what you think. And it was, you know, literally just tasting barrel by barrel and identifying some possible wines that might be cool to be bottled.
And there's definitely barrel influence.
Oh, yeah. And 19, you know, it's not a ripe year, not a tropical year, but the acid was the thing that was really striking to me. These were Burgundy barrels. They weren't 225s. They were 250s. Just the leanness, focusing on the acid was really it. I mean, my feeling is always with food, you know, acid first, right. Fruit first. This is probably the oakiest wine of the whole bunch that's ever been done. But it was still very striking, and it was a great gateway wine for a lot of folks too.
Certainly not what anyone who thinks Sauvignon Blanc and they go Marlboro, get out there. I mean, just don't even think about that. That wouldn't fit this as well. My first thing is, I think I would be leaning towards like cool climate Chardonnay. That's the first thing on the nose. Yeah, you know, if you're doing blind, that's, I think, where I would first start to go.
And Chard's something that I do want to target down the line, too. It's been on the radar since the beginning. But, you know, doing it in a way that sort of sort of leans us. I'm not going to say, you know, let's do it like Chablis, but yeah. Let's find out what the sites are really saying, because that is a factor too. So,
you know what I want, even though like I want someone to go, you know, we want to make a Chardonnay, but we want to make a high end premium Chardonnay, and we just want to oak the shit out of it. No one ever, everyone, and I get it, because anything overly oaky is you know, it's bad. It kills the terroir, and it just makes it generic. But I just want one person to go, yeah, you know, when I think of Chardonnay, the first thing I think of is oak. Really new, tightly wound oak, just lapping my shores with butter. You're right about the acid.
Yeah.
On the Sauvignon Blanc. When'd you fall in love with wine?
You know, it was sort of an accidental thing. It was, honestly, Riverview Cellars used to be Riverview Farms. Mm-hmm. And when I was in high school, that was just a part-time job that I picked up. And as they transitioned to becoming a winery, I learned along with them. So it was a very organic process from, you know, being a 19-year-old, having absolutely no idea, you know, what this, that, or the other is. But if you're given a tour, You've got you know, a basic script, but you've got questions that come at you, so you want to find out what do I need to know to get right. ahead of that next part, and you know, there's no shortage of information, things to learn. Now, how did you get into wine? I don't know this about you, but
I'll tell it fast. Yeah. Wine was always in the family, and so I was always just kind of always around. And then one time, he and a bunch of his friends. All they would get together and they would cook these giant meals together, and everyone would bring wine. Mm-hmm. And one of Sesto's friends brought an old bottle of Barolo, brick orange. And I looked at it, I'm like, that looks gross. That looks disgusting. I'm in my mid-20s at the time.
Yep.
You know, I like, you know, a couple of years earlier, I thought Merlot meant Italian red wine. Yeah, that's, I enjoyed what I was drinking, but I knew nothing about it.
Yeah.
And then I had a sip and I started to laugh because it was that good. And I got goosebumps. I just poured a way too heavy pour, and I just said, I want to be alone. I love this wine so much, I just wanted to think about it and drink it. So I had that moment. Then that following Christmas, he opened up an old Amarone, Magnum old Amarone. I told my brother Scott, I'm like, yeah, this Magnum, this giant thing of wine, we're never going to finish it. And then an hour or so later, I'm like, Scott, get over here. This bottle is going, it's going fast. I'm saving you a glass. So soon after that, I started to go to wine bars and restaurants that had good wine lists.
Yeah.
And I would write stuff down. You know, this is before having any sort of smartphone.
Yeah.
And then I found out what I liked and what I didn't like. And then I would explore. Oh, okay. I enjoy, because when you're younger, you enjoy bigger. Like, oh, Lodi Zinfandel. I'm enjoying this. Experiment more with that. Next thing you know, you're in WSET. Next thing you know, you're spending 5 nights in a hotel on your own before your WSET diploma. And then here we are.
Well, that's awesome. And do you remember which Barolo it was?
I don't. I wish I did. I just remember they said Barolo. They said it was Northern Italy. I didn't even know Nebbiolo.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I just looked at the color, and I thought it was gross. And then I just fell in love with it.
And the funny thing is about when you mentioned that, because I had a similar type of situation when I had some friends over. There were two bottles of wine. One was a 97 Borgogno Barolo, and it was, I remember, I was very young, I was like 19 or 20, and it was $67. It was a, you know, a classics wine that was delisted.
Yep.
I bought that, and I bought a 1295 Salice Salentino, like, yep. Just something simple. Everybody in the group loved the cheap wine. And they all found the Barolo to be completely, like, just inaccessible.
Yeah.
We decanted it and left it alone, came back to it, and the expression, like the mushroom you know, rose just came up in such a profound way that was, I mean, it's a light bulb thing, but getting back to Niagara, I think we have that potential to do that too. I mean, obviously the Pinots are, you know, evolving and improving in such a way that it would be great to get to that level of first moment exposure for a lot of people too.
Yeah.
I mean, where's your light bulb moment? Maybe it's Riesling. Maybe for some people it is Riesling. Maybe it's something entirely different. But
I've had light bulb moments with Ontario, with Pinot Noir, with Gamay, with Chardonnay, with Cab Franc. Like, I think, you know, those are for some killer, a lot of killer sparklings as well. As we're taping this on July 20th, the first one I fell in love with was James Lottie's Long Dog, which is in Prince Edward County, Chardonnay and Pinot House. He passed away a couple weeks ago. I was devastated because that was my first Ontario wine love. you know, that sort of started to open my eyes. And then, you know, okay, this Clausen Chase and Rose Hall Run, and then, you know, 13th Street and Batchelder and Cloudsley, and it just, and then it goes on and on. And I remember, I have this thing where I wonder, could I survive just drinking wine from one country? And I realized at some point, yep, I could do that with Ontario. Yeah. From a Soyuz in Okanagan to Prince Edward County, Niagara, get a little East Coast sparkling, and I realized I could, you know, I could do it. I could be fully happy if I, you know, if I had to be stuck with Canadian wine.
Oh, there's nothing to be stuck about. But
no,
yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah, another, I'm teasing you with all the things you can't have. I'm sorry.
Yeah, so yeah. Well, would you pour now? And Joel said this line that I almost never think I would ever hear. We're sold out of the Gewürztraminer. Because Gewürztraminer is scary. Gewürztraminer intimidates. And I have this rule. If I pour someone a glass of Gewürztraminer, I tell them ahead of time, like, hey, this is Gewürztraminer. It's going to be big. It's going to be funky. It might be meaty. But just don't think of it as an offhanded lemon lime alcohol delivery system. I have to warn people ahead of time. And so this is sold out. Good for you.
Yeah. Thanks so much. Yeah, so this is the 21, 2021 Eunoia Gewürztraminer. Some wines have fun, fancy, you know, complicated names. Eunoia is a book of poetry by Christian Bach, where all vowels are used in individual chapters. That's not important. The important thing is this is a dry Gewürztraminer from vines that were actually two sets of vines, one planted in 92, the other planted in 04. There was a special yeast that was used to sort of improve mouthfeel, which I'll not pronounce properly, but something along the lines of Torolaspora del Brucchi.
That's pretty damn good.
Well, that's, hey, listen, it's like speaking another language. As long as you can fake it, I try to sound as Latin as possible.
You said it quickly, but not too quickly, with confidence.
Yeah, just like the Italians.
Yeah, exactly.
So, but actually, it's interesting. So this was made at Riverview Cellars, and the first, it's not the first time this wine has sort of been in the world. It would have been, I think, the 09 Gewürz that won the White Wine of the Year at the Cuvée Awards when it was a competition.
Ah, cool.
So this was there's some history behind it, but it's always, I mean, that's from the Niagara River sub-appellation. And, you know, to get into talking about sub-appellations, if you like, I think that, you know, a lot of producers, because it's like, this is not about me, this is about our industry as a whole, finding the sweet spots for all these regions, finding the grapes that do well, finding the sites within those sites, or within those zones to do well. I have to say, you know, Niagara River, great, it's fun. Mm-hmm. Grapes that benefit from a little extra heat, slightly earlier ripening times.
So Niagara River, just for people, it's a little bit warmer microclimate.
The key with that is that because of the proximity to the water, that which is closest will tend to ripen up earlier, but you do get some moderating influence that helps. Like, there aren't a lot of wineries along that stretch. And, you know, like everybody sort of, I mean, Four Mile Creek, it's a big zone. It's a lot of Virgil. And those vines get really, you know, they can get very, very warm. I mean, I think that, in a broad generic term, I mean, a lot of people look at delicate wines out of, you know, everything in the bench, warmer, bigger varieties out of Niagara on the Lake. There are exceptions for all of those.
Of course.
And part of those are soil-based. Part of those are, you know, microclimate variations. But, I think that, you know, when you think about classic examples of Gewürztraminer, I don't really think about Germany so much as I think of Alsace.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, to have that extra strength, power, and viscosity, that's sort of the direction to go in. Now, this is not particularly high in alcohol, but again, it's sort of a moot point anyway. So it's built as a food wine.
This is a good, and when I say starter, I don't mean that it lacks depth or character, but this is not as intense as a lot of Alsatian Gewürztraminer. As you said, it's dry, but it still has the meatiness. Like, that's the first thing. There's a couple of things I'm always looking for Gewürztraminer, but I'm not getting overwhelmed by it. Just like your Sauvignon Blanc isn't Marlboro, this Gewürztraminer is an Alsatian. And I don't mean that as a compliment. I don't mean that as a criticism. I mean, this is a good starter Gewürztraminer. I can see how it sells out. How many, you talked about before, again, you're small.
Oh,
how much do you make?
They're small batches. You know, they're you know, 50 cases, 60 cases,
right.
80 cases, you know, just little expressions, right?
Yeah.
And some might be around 100, but the idea is that it's sort of a moment in time. If you can try it, enjoy it, great. But then once it's gone, it's gone.
So, and I say on the front end, generalizations are bad. We always get scared of generalizations. But if people see Niagara River, they should think that generally that's probably a little bit warmer region. Thus, if you're going for your bigger reds and you see, oh, this bigger red from this Niagara winery, oh, it says Niagara River, at the very least, I have a better chance of enjoying it because at the very least, this grape certainly belongs in that sub-appellation. Is that sort of a, and again, generalization, but is that somewhat of a correct oversimplification?
Generally, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I always want to dance around it because I'm always nervous about the generalizations because, you know, you can get slapped for it, and a lot of times you should. So you see that. Like, is there any other of the appellations that you think that, and this is more for the buyer that's getting into Ontario Niagara wines. If they see certain words like Four Mile Creek, what should they think? Or, you know, Beamsville Bench or things like that.
Yeah, with Four Mile Creek, I usually think juicy, broad, and structured. With Beamsville Bench, I think lean, sort of, not to say austere, but fresh, mm-hmm. and, you know, with great presence. And I think when you talk about a lot of the wineries that are out in each of these zones, the character that they have sort of honed over the years, they're all very distinct. And it's not, I mean, part of it is the personalities behind it. But at the same time, you know, the site is becoming more and more clear. And I just love the variety that mm-hmm. we have in the province to begin with. Like, it's not a, you know, it's never about one person. It's about a love letter to the region, right?
So yeah.
To appreciate those differences.
And really, as I said, I always think that's important because I always say, I want people to try Niagara wines, not because I have a passport that says I'm Canadian, but because it's really good. I think everyone should continue to buy all their old world wines. But if, you know, if you're a fan of Burgundy, if you're a fan of Italy, you know, different regions, one reason why we're a fan of these areas is because every appellation feels, tastes, smells a little bit distinctive. That trait is certainly here in Niagara, and I think that's important for people to know.
Yeah, we just have to keep working at it. And, you know, somebody asked me recently, is it more important to drink local if it's anything? And, you know, my feeling is sure, you know, great, drink local, you know, if the option is nothing else. But trying to develop that appreciation for the deeper knowledge, that's something that, you know, it's not always easy to do if you're just buying at the store. You know, you have to go there. You have to. So, you know, if we can take nothing out, if we can advertise anything else, it's just get out, visit. It's the best time of the year to go.
Yeah.
And not to me because I don't have a place to visit. But just to experience it and to enjoy it, you know, to put wine culture to the forefront, right? And to sort of develop that appreciation, foster that appreciation, which, you know, Matt, maybe not all winemakers get to tell you this and record it, but we certainly appreciate everything that you've been doing for the region because it's so critical that as everybody's growing up and learning, they have those sources and they have those places to turn to.
Thank you. I mean, no, it means a lot. And again, I always say I don't do it because I crusade. I do it because I just started to fall in love with Niagara and Prince Edward County. And then I would drive around and then I set the podcast. And then I meet interesting people. Like, hey, that's the W podcast. I love hearing everyone's stories. Everyone has different stories and they're cool. And there's a lot of really good wine that's being made. I'm just trying to get it out there. And again, fourthwallwines.com. Let's talk about your collaborations. I know in some of the wines, Malvoir, Pearl Morset, you know, you hook up with a lot of these great wineries. I was wondering if you could take me through how that all works.
Not to spoil your question, but everything is different. And I think some of this happened during COVID, and those kinds of collaborations were entirely different. You know, oftentimes it would be on the weekend. You know, you got a little bit of time. You get out, you say hi, you taste around, you talk, and but each of the winemakers, and you know, I do feel it's important to you know, credit them and to stress their work because their contributions are all unique and different. You know, they have wines that are, you know, pre-designated for a lot of different areas, but sometimes there may be some vineyards that produce a little more or a little less. My process of blending with them is basically just tasting components, figuring out, identifying what characteristics they have, and then collaborating on what can be actually put into reality. What can we actually put down on the table? Actually, if you want to, maybe let's get another wine going here.
Sure, we'll take a quick break and get back up again in one moment.
Picture this: your Canada Day, 2020. I don't know what you were doing, but
July 2020.
July 2020, Canada Day.
Yeah, I was
July 2020.
Probably just hanging out at the cottage, being able to do my radio show from a remote location.
Yeah, and we were all in that spot where, you know, you're not really going places, but you're getting that itch now.
Yeah,
remember it was going to be 2 weeks.
Yeah,
it was going to be two.
God,
weeks.
That's so true. Oh, it's going to be 2 weeks. Oh, it's going to be a month. Oh, it's going to be yeah.
I was the worst. I told my neighbor after it happened, and the kids were sent home, right? And she said, you know, oh, it's just going to be 2 weeks. I said, oh, it's just another 18 months. What a terrible thing to get right.
And your kids are 3 and 5 at the time.
I guess so, yeah. It's been a blur. So, yeah. But anyway, so Canada Day, drive down to Niagara Falls because, you know, there's nobody down there, right? Mm-hmm. And I'd been talking with the assistant winemaker over at Riverview about, you know, let's just see what else is in the tank, what's around. And so Nick sent, he said, you know, like, it's COVID. We can't really taste and stuff, but I'll make you up some mock bottles.
Yeah.
And so he did a bunch of samples of various things, got like 12, 13 different wines. And I tried the Pinot Gris that he'd been working on in tank and with some other things too. But I was just floored by how fresh and how cool it was. It'd been on lees for, you know, the length of its life.
Mm-hmm.
There was some that was off in barrel as well, but it was kind of like a lightning in a bottle situation. You know, we didn't taste it then and there. You know, the kids were falling asleep because it was you know, this is middle of July, or it's the start of July, hot as anything. But you know, Pinot Gris is a grape that we haven't done perhaps as much with in Ontario, and you know, maybe for good reason. I mean,
economic reasons. It's a harder sell. People don't know what it is. Like, oh, Pinot Grigio, that's Pinot Grigio. That's the same thing. I'll grab a $14 bottle from Northeast Italy.
Exactly. And those are great wines in their own right for what you're looking for. But you know, we're not mountainous here. You know, we're right. Flatlands, and well, I mean, to an extent. And I think part of the fun part of this project too is starting to learn and identify what we can do. Like, I remember back when I was at Canoe, the amount of Pinot Gris that I loved coming out of Niagara was very limited. And I remember it was Poplar Grove from out in BC that we continue to buy. There are a lot of good examples, but it was, you didn't hit the richness that I think I kind of like out of it anyways. But being that Pinot is part of, you know, the family of Chardonnay and Pinot Noir, and being in that general camp, if we can do Chardonnay and Pinot, not Pinot Noir, why not Pinot Gris? And why not in a substantial way? So this is sort of, to me, the a wine made in not quite Alsace, not quite Trentino. It's Niagara. Mm-hmm. And I think finding a groove for those grapes in, you know, year to year, I think that's sort of a good way to look at it. You know, there's a winery in Alto Adige, Franz Haas, that uses a kind of like a sliding scale let's call it seasoning oak, but, you know, 5 to 15% of barrel influence just to sort of round out and
right.
Based on the vintage. And so in 19, it was 5%. In 20, it was 10%. You know, hotter year, just amp it up.
By the way, first off, the one thing I appreciate, I love vintage variation. I've always talked about it. I love vintage variation. There is so much vintage variation on your 19 and 20.
Yep.
These are completely different wines. So I appreciate it because it means you're respecting the terroir. You're not afraid of alienating some customers that they like one wine. They want every wine to be like that. It's like, well, we don't make Scotch or Pepsi. Things are going to taste. And by the way, I'm not comparing Scotch and Pepsi. I'm saying it's a different sort of, you know, approach to things.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can see, you know, cool, wet, 19,
yes.
Things struggling to ripen.
Yes.
This site, it's the same site. This is all the same site. And if you look at the, you know, year to year, sandy soils, crops are managed appropriately for what it was, but the core that I get through all of this, there's an apricot dimension to each of these three wines. There's, in front of your glass, for those who are not watching the YouTube version of this, there's a 19, a 20, and a 22. There was no 21. 21 was a little more rain.
Yep.
So a little more breakdown. And we made more in 20 than in 19. So I thought, oh, you know what? Let's just roll the dice and wait till 22. So, but the site I think is, yeah, for me, honey, mushroom, yes. apricot, first vintage that was made was 07. So I think it was an 03 planting, 04 planting. So yeah, you're getting close to 20 years.
For the vine age. Yeah. And the 20, there's almost like I get a tiny hint of like a well-made Pinot Sherry.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
It's and this is not me saying it's oxidized or anything like that, but just they're so different. By the way, I was going to ask, what was your pitch when you went to these vineyards about, hey, I'd like to collaborate? You know, I don't own 7,000 rows of wine. But I'm wondering, what was your, because obviously a lot of this is based on your relationships. You've grown up in the area. You know these people. You like them. They like you. There's the level of trust, you know, your knowledge of wine and respect for it. But I'm just curious what the pitch was.
Well, you know, I just bring along a little video of Puss in Boots from the Shrek movie with the big eyes and everything. And then it's just, I learned that from the kids. And then, of course,
It always works. No, but I'm just curious for the listeners going, wait a minute, virtually he's working with winemakers, you know, just how it all went together.
Well, I think, you know, I think that the way it's sort of been is, you know, having open conversations about finding ways to help everybody succeed and for everybody to grow in the same way. You know, I find that when I was at Canoe, the thing that I would try a million wines and I would love so many of them, but there was always my back of my head thinking, I love this, but what if it were just a little different?
Right.
What if it were just, and my thing is I never wanted to turn anybody away. I always wanted to make sure to bring more into the table. It's it's not the no, but it's the yes and jinx. So there's, so my feeling is, you know, the more we can work together, the better we all are in the end.
Right.
So, the 22.
This is this is an interesting one where you had a fight with the LCBO.
Not the LCBO. With the VQA. It wasn't even a fight. It's more of
difference of opinion.
So you know this. So for those who can't see the wine, you can look up on the Instagram. But there is an Instagram account if you want it. Please go ahead and follow it if you're on the platform. You know at Fourth Wall Wines. So the 2022 Pinot Gris was done in a skin contact fashion. It was fermented on its skins, but it was only fermented for 5 days. I mean, Pinot Gris, Matt knows, is a dark purple-colored grape. Like the skins are not similar to, you know, like you would see Chardonnay or Riesling.
Yeah.
There's some pigment to it. And so after five, it was tannic enough. It was, in fact, this is 20% of the batch has been through barrel, so it's actually softened up a bit than where it was. But the legal requirement for an orange wine in Ontario is 10 days. So you know.
So this orange wine is, by VQA standards, is a white wine.
We're probably both going to get in trouble for this, Matt.
Oh, it's okay. Listen, it looks like an orange wine. Kind of smells a little bit like an orange wine. I'd say it tastes a lot like an orange wine.
Well, then duck, and duck. Yeah.
There are so many laws and finickiness when it comes to alcohol in this province, in this country. I'm not shocked at all. I mean, Pearl Merced, they've had to deal that before with some of their wines, and it's kind of part of the industry. I'm debating which one I like more between the 19 and the 20 of the Pinot Gris. But again, I appreciate how different they are. So, when you're working with the vineyards or the winemakers, is it that they allow you to purchase a certain amount of the juice, and then you decide the blending, or so, like what's the product? Because I know it says you're not the winemaker, but you are, as you mentioned just a moment ago, in charge of all the blending.
So the blend, So the way I kind of put it is, you know, I've been fortunate enough to, you know, have the control to do final blend decisions with the winemakers, and like we don't adjust necessarily. Like, there's no, like, you know, we're not adding sugar, not adding acid, nothing like that.
Yeah.
And that's part of the other things too. They are hands off wines as much as can be. Like they're cleanly made. We'll filter as necessary and so forth because we want them to be stable. But the hand, like the thumbprint of any winemaker, I feel it's important that it's on there. You know, when you try. Like this Gamay that Shiraz made, Shiraz Motiar from Malabar, you will you say, you know what? Absolutely, this is a Shiraz wine. Mm-hmm. If you try the Cabernet Franc from Pearl Morissette, you should identify that as a wine from Pearl Morissette. And I think that, you know, just as much as region is important, you know, winemaker personality, styles, those factors are really, you know, significant to our makeup. There was an ad campaign that Wines of Ontario ran back in the early 2000s, and
I'm already cringing.
I loved it. It was thumbprints as grapes, and the, you know, because everybody to the wineries, they sent all this these little you know notepads out. I thought I like that. I know it sounds a little.
Can I find it on YouTube?
I don't know. This was all print material back then. I don't think YouTube didn't exist in 2000.
That is true. It didn't. It didn't. Know? It was more like a 2006-07 thing before it happened.
Yeah, but. Yeah, but you know, I think that you know, when you make a say, for example, you're a somm, you're at a restaurant, mm-hmm. you're building a wine list. How are you fleshing it out? So how are you building it? You can't rely on necessarily one style. You want to try to offer variety and diversity.
Yeah,
and so to make your to make your selections, you respect budget and price point, but you also try to cover the needs, right? And in my mind, when I started, it was not with any particular intention. It was, you know, let's just see what we can make. Let's try to make the best wines possible. The first wines that were made, it was Cabernet Sauvignon, which I didn't expect because...
The first wine you made was a Cabernet Sauvignon?
Well, yeah, with when I tasted, when Mike said, come by the winery, mm-hmm. I said, let's taste through the...
So, sorry, with which winery?
That was with Riverview.
Okay, yeah,
And I figured it would be a Merlot or a Cab Franc because I've loved their Merlot for years. And I thought, you know, that'll be what it is. And go in, I taste, and there was a 1,000-liter barrel of Cabernet Sauvignon, which, of course, vines were quite old at that point, too. Mm-hmm. And it was just so fresh and so stunning. I loved it. It's not a cab for the cab drinker.
No.
But it's if you want to find a great Ontario Cabernet.
Yeah.
I thought it was that. And by the same stroke, we did found some Gamay in the tank that was just awesome. It was ripping. It's from the Bader Vineyard, and mm-hmm. That's the site that Thomas Batchelder has now been able to make some great single vineyards with. But you may have found it earlier around the pandemic by the Glass of Treadwell years ago, and you know, that was a great spot. I mean, James has been an amazing supporter mm-hmm. of this project, but also everything from Ontario. So, you know, to find some of those restaurants that seek out the gems and seek out the tough to find stuff. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
I think I like the 20 because it's a little funkier. It's challenging me a little bit more.
Yep.
And I like that. I have this thing. I like big whites. I can pair with steak. At the same point, last year for my birthday, I said I want to be in Mosul. So I'm sort of all over the place with my white wines, but I do have a special place in my heart. I think it's because I love Southern Rhone whites and like whites from like Vacarin and stuff like that. Which, by the way, now I sound like such a wine hipster douche by saying that. But I do like the big challenging white wines.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I like that one a lot. Yeah.
Again, as I said, I'm not as big on the orange one. But I've never been a huge orange wine guy.
Well, that was sort of more experimentation.
We
talked about experimenting back in 11, sorry, in 21, you know, too much breakdown, and they've got to be clean for that to happen. So,
and as I always say, if you like everything, you love nothing. You know, so that's always my point. But yeah, those are good Pinot Gris. Yeah, I think right now, because as someone who works in sports, I always have to try to rank. I think the Riesling and the 20 Pinot Gris have been my favorites so far.
This is the power ranking section. So.
Yeah. I could do that. I could do full sport. Could just turn like sports commentary. Well,
why don't we go through the next three and we'll try to apply the probable, questionable, or doubtful tag to any of those.
We'll put the mic down for 1 second. And we're back. And so we've got a Cab Franc, a Gamay Noir, and what is... this one that looks like an incredibly intense rosé. What do we got here?
Bricolage, first rosé.
Bricolage.
Bricolage, you know, in art, if you're creating something that's, you know, using a disparate styles. And,
fun.
Yeah, it's. I wanted to, for a while, I've wanted to have a rosé that was like a Cersuolo. but just had to have enough bounce and pop and zip. And so this is a single vineyard. It's a mixture of a few different grapes. I keep it a little close to the vest, but a combination of Cab Sauve, Cab Franc, Gewurz, Merlot, and Riesling. I mean,
Jesus, so you got a little bit of everything in this fella.
That's a bricolage. And in 2022, just to kind of like for the listener that maybe doesn't work in in wine in the area, 2019, cool, wet vintage, so cooler, fresher wines. 2020, hot vintage, vintage of the year, vintage of the century, easy, clean, everything healthy. 2021, rain. And 22, unfortunately, a lot of the region experienced some significant crop loss. Some were completely wiped out. People have spoken to different reasons about this. I mean, we've had cold damage through the last 20 years or so that people have really pointed to. But in 22, there was just less of everything available.
Right.
And so my thinking was, we could do micro batches, or we could just make a little bit more. And because I love some of these things, I loved how they played around together. And this was, tasting, having flights of little this, that, and the other,
yep,
and just trying to identify what would be awesome. So this is just a killer crushing rosé.
Yes, this is intense raspberry.
Yeah,
I never pronounce it correctly. Ebullient. It's like EB.
I think you got it.
Fresh,
yeah,
coming,
yeah,
at, yeah, you. Whatever, yeah, that word is. God, I mispronounce, yeah, it all the time. That's what this fella is. It's just a bunch of very fresh red fruit coming at you on the nose and on the palate. Yeah, for people go, oh, I don't like my rosé because I don't know what it is. Is it red wine? Is it white wine? What's going on here? This one sort of leans more towards this is a heavier, not on the body, but on the palate. This is a big, fresh red fruit. This is a fun, rosé coming at you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, I think it's funny because a lot of people have said to me, guests are, they see something dark and they think, oh, it's going to be sweet, but it's not.
No.
There's nothing pretty
sweet
bracing
about
there.
That. And you could get fooled. You pour this and someone's going to think Beaujolais. They might not even know it's rosé until they're halfway in it. Before we get to the Gamay Noir and the Cap,
yeah,
Franc, just some of your experiences working at Canoe. I always love talking to former Somms who were at famous restaurants. And, I've been there a couple times and always been impressed. And crazy list, crazy view. But, what are some of the war stories? What are some of the behind-the-scenes things that you're allowed to talk about?
Oh, there's so much that we can't talk about.
I know. By the way, that's so true, you guys. You guys all suck. I remember talking to Will Pridham, and it's funny. You ask questions about, come on, who is the craziest guest? And I'm Will hasn't worked there in ages, and he still clams up. And I feel the same things coming from you.
No, it's funny when you're in that environment, you hang on every experience. And it, for me, it was never the famous guest that you pay attention to. It was you want to make the regular, the person who comes in, once a week, twice a week,
yep,
maybe even once a month. You want to make them feel extra special, but you want to make every person, even if it's their first time, feel like it's they're the most important diner there. And and it's not always possible. I mean, it's you try your best to identify what they love and they need. The one story, maybe if you want it, I can give you the my old table one story.
I want to hear it. I'm just going to say this about the Cab Franc. That just screams Pearl Morissette.
Yeah.
I'm smelling it, but yes, I want to hear the story. Tell the story.
Yeah, so it was a night where I was closing. Table one is a table that is close to the chef's rail. Mm-hmm. So in the open kitchen, it's along the window, close to the front. Great spot. Every table is a great table, but...
By the window is a little gray term.
Just for some reason.
I'll say you don't have to.
Yeah.
If you're by the window, I have found when you're at the CN Tower, being by a window is pretty awesome because, the view. Not that the other tables, you can still see the view, but being by the window gives you just a teeny weeny bit more access to said view.
Yeah. Man and a woman out, one of their early dates, maybe the first date, and he's looking to impress her. They call, the server says, hey, Joel, come over. they want to buy something nice, and I sell him on a second growth Bordeaux because he wanted to kind of shoot for the moon. We open it, decant it. It's great. I know that the mains are going to be involving some red meat. I think it was lamb and steak that they were both having, so that's cool. We're good for pairings. I figured, all right, this will be good for the rest of the meal. They're just two people. But, of course, they're halfway through the mains. Server seems to get the nod that they want another bottle of wine. So instead of me going by, Will is actually the one who goes by, and yep. Will Preedom. And
Preedom. Yeah, I said Preedom. I'm an idiot. Anyway, sorry. Yeah.
Sells them on the Quintarelli Alzero.
And for people, explain just in 30 seconds or less when the word Quintarelli is thrown around. What does that mean?
So famous Veneto producer, Passamento grapes. The Alzero is their Cabernet Franc. So it's actually kind of an interesting connection because you're going from Bordeaux to Bordeaux variety, basically, but different region. The only difference is the Quintarelli Alzero is going to be a supercharged wine, a little more alcohol, slightly riper, sweeter fruit.
Yeah. And it's expensive. Still, incredibly expensive, but Quintarelli, that's one of the top names. If you ever have a chance, you know, if you want to try an Amarone and someone offers you a glass of a Quintarelli Amarone,
just say yes.
Just, you know, to quote from Ghostbusters, if someone asks if you're a god, you say yes. I figured you would get that reference.
People of a certain age. Yeah.
Is going to get that. Okay, yep. Second growth Bordeaux. Yeah. Now they're going on a Cap Franc Quintarelli.
Yeah.
I've never even tried one of those.
Oh, yeah, you have to. I mean, if you got $850 to laying around.
Done.
Just to,
there.
That's the money chair. Yeah. So anyways, they get it, and it's decanted, and but they don't drink much. They pull me over later as they're finishing their meal. They say, you know, this is a wonderful wine. Really appreciate this. We've had enough, and it's a late night. We've had a great time. Why don't you take the rest of the bottle home? And I said, you know, this is not something that we make a habit of. In fact, you know, direct gratuities were never something that, you know, we really saw a lot of, and that's totally cool. But I said, you know, listen, I don't feel right about doing this. I appreciate it, but I'll share it with the staff if that's the case. So, okay, great. So they did leave it. They left about four-fifths of the bottle. And
Wait a minute. What do you mean they were done? They were just like, we don't need any more Quintarelli. We shall now move on with our lives. Is that what you're telling me?
They knew their limit, and they played within it.
I wish I was there with them. I mean, no one wants a third wheel on an early date, but I'd be like, listen, hey, you kids, you're a great young couple. You leave. I'll just stay here with the rest of the Quintarelli and enjoy the view from this great table.
Well, you know, closing is a tough gig, and sometimes you win the lottery on that kind of stuff. But
okay.
So anyways,
yeah, so you got the ball.
So shared it with the staff that was there. Still had a little bit left. So maybe cork goes in, wine comes home. Next day we're going to our friends in Hamilton. And I don't know what they're serving for dinner, but I thought, wow, we haven't seen this couple in a while. Be great to share it. And sure enough, when we get there, I find out that we are having KFC.
Very nice.
Yep. And the mix of high and low was never higher nor lower, but the company was fantastic, and and that was you'd be surprised how the MSG plays with the Appassimento, but
that is hilarious. I love the idea of you got this iconic wine and you're having it with the Dirty Bird.
Hey, look, sometimes you can't make these choices. Some wines are simply thrust upon you, and you just succeed with what you get. So
I love it. That's and by the way, part of that's just a lot of fun. Like, I'm sorry, but this crazy high-end wine, that's something that maybe you only drink once a year, and you're having it with fast food. There is something fun about the novelty of that.
Yeah.
So we got a Gamay Noir, and we've got a Cab Franc. The Gamay Noir, who is the Super Wonder Twin? Who did you team up with on this one? I could do a lot of WWF old references. Let's see, British Bulldogs. You know, or the Killer Bees, B. Brian Blair and Jumping Jim Brunzel. Not that I remember that stuff. I remember all that stuff. So who's this with?
Well, not to try to do my terrible Macho Man Randy Savage impression, but listen, brother. No, wait, was that Hulk Hogan? I forget.
No. It's been a few years. Well, brother. brother is Hulk Hogan.
Right.
Listen, brother. But then, That's Randy Macho Man.
Right. It's been a while.
It's been a while. Yeah.
This was made at Malivore.
Yep.
With Shiraz Motiar. So Shiraz, of course, just a Gamay whisperer. This was a combination of a few different sites. We had access to the Openlander Vineyard, which is relatively close to where the Bader Vineyard was. Weans, Enns, in smaller components. 9% of this is Wismar Foxcroft. That was done semi-carbonic in a demijohn.
And by the way, I'm going to interrupt.
Yep.
For anyone listening, if you see the word Wismar Foxcroft on the bottle of Ontario wine, and then you see that the price is, say, $45, $50, that's one of the better vineyard sites in all of Ontario.
Yeah, and I this is just one of those like trivia bits where we have to give a real shout out. I think Kevin Panagapka, 2027, was one of the first to my memory, and I may be wrong, but I remember when he kind of came on the scene. Not just came on the scene, but one of the first big impact wines was his bottling from there.
And
so you're driving up. Like if you drive up Vineland or Victoria Avenue, and you see the little dip, and you can think of where that little sun trap is, and
I know exactly where that is.
Yeah.
I've had him on the pod, and he pointed out, he's like, that wine's from there, that wine's from there, that wine's from there. And again, I'm hammering this again. I think that's so important for people to realize there is prestige in these wines. Anyway.
So when we were, for example, when we were working on this, it was, you know, a bunch of the different components, but that Wismar Foxcroft lifted the rest of it all so completely. The follow-up vintage, the 2020, was just Openlander and Wismar Foxcroft, 80-20. But this one, I think, you know, 19s, again, as a cooler vintage, it's the kind of wines that I love seeing, so fresh.
And this is the 19 Gamay Noir.
It's
when you were telling me before the canoe story about the, by the way, what a night. Second growth Bordeaux, and then Quintarelli.
I hope the couple made it. You know,
I hope they did as well.
I hope they're listening, and they know how much I appreciate that, and how they're part of my life too.
Yeah. Now this is lovely. Like this, by the way, for people who don't know, when they see the word Gamay Noir, is that Gamay and Pinot together? Is that a different grape altogether? When they say Gamay Noir, what is it? And what should they expect?
Oh, you know, Gamay is, in Burgundy, you know, Gamay is thought of as a lesser grape, but it does a lot of the same things that that Pinot does. And I think that, and you've talked about this, everybody has, how Ontario winemakers love the consistency and just year-to-year stability of Gamay. It seems like, you know, we're getting better and better at handling it. But light wine, fresh wine, juicy wine, not necessarily big and structured. If you're looking at flavors, you know, cherry, raspberry, perhaps some strawberry. Those are the kind of flavors and directions you get. You don't get so much of the dark, deep herbal notes that you'd get out of the Bordeaux varieties. And sometimes pepper as well. I do find some pepper kind of creeps in from time to time, but not as distinctly as, say, Syrah. I mean, like when we can grow Syrah in Ontario, when it survives, it can be really compelling. It can be really fragrant.
Creekside.
Oh, yeah.
They do it great, obviously. Cassaba.
Yeah,
you know, for people, because people love to hear when someone sees the word Gamay Noir. Is that Gamay and Pinot Noir? Or is that its own grape?
No. Gamay Noir is its own grape. You can call it Gamay. You can call it Gamay Noir. Mm-hmm. Same deal.
Perfect. Just for people listening.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And then finally, I mean, this Cab Franc. This is a great wine, and I've been lucky enough. I've drank a bunch of Pro Morset over the years. And I'm not going to be like, oh, I could blind it every time. You could pour me it and I'll call it some, you know, like, oh, this is Rioja. I'm like, no, you dummy, you're wrong. This smells, I haven't tried it yet. This smells like just a really good high-end Ontario Cab Franc.
I think that this kind of Cab Franc could settle in against some Bordeaux expressions and some Loire expressions as well. But you're right, like Ontario as a region has loved Cabernet Franc, has tried to embrace it. I think, and that's why, you know, these two have the blue meta label to try to say these are great grapes for the region. And so
right.
If and when a Chardonnay and a Pinot come out, they'll have a blue label too. This is Now, this is where site's really important. Now, these are clay-rich soils. The Redfoot Vineyard, they've been leasing from the Kosas family for a few years now, and it's just very close to where Redstone is,
yep.
Where the Stauch Vineyard is that Malivoire's been making wine from. This is a portion is Redfoot. The portion at the time was called Il Vigneto. Now it is called a Grimsby Hillside. And another slightly fresher, clay-rich, but also gravelly soil. And the two sets of fruit were co-fermented, aged in demi-mood. And it's, again, another hands-off type of wine. But if you're looking at structure and site, this is one of the ripest 19s that I've tried. Because 19...
Oh, this is 19?
Yeah, this is 19.
Damn.
So as a Bordeaux enthusiast, a lot of people will skip 19 because the 19s can be too vegetal.
Yeah.
This has herbal notes insofar as it's tobacco, which is typical, but it's not like it's not green. It's proper Cab Franc, and that was the real strength. I was just like,
yeah.
I was like, oh, I can't ask for a nicer wine than this. This is just awesome.
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
Two questions before we end. One, one of my favorite movies of all time. I've often told, especially when I was younger, I would always tell girlfriends, if you want to know the mind of men, just go watch High Fidelity. just go watch. Like, I remember watching the first time going, I'm like, there's so many things that John Cusack's going through. I'm like, I'm the exact same way. How do you relate the movie High Fidelity with your wines?
Oh, my God. One of my favorite films. Top five wines. So I think there's so many little nuances. And by the way, did you see the reboot of that?
I heard TV show. There's too much TV on.
Yeah.
There's too much TV. I'm on season two of Barry as I'm finishing Succession. There's too much TV. There's way too much TV on.
Oh, my God. No, I love Succession. So...
By the way, hyper decanting. Get the fuck. Just no. No. Okay. Do not put your wine in a blender. Never put your wine in a blender unless it's Meiomi. Then do whatever the hell you want with it.
So in that movie, there's that scene near the end where John Cusack decides to put out the record with the punk kids.
Yeah.
Top five records. And, you know, his girlfriend is very supportive of it. And, you know, it's that line, which I'm probably going to butcher because it's been, you know, 10, 15 years since I've watched it. But, you know, you've spent so many years as a professional appreciator. Don't you want to put something out into the world or something along
those
lines?
Get into the game.
Yeah. There you go.
Yeah.
And when I started with wine, I was, you know, 18 going on 19. I could serve. In fact, I was 18. I could serve it, but I couldn't drink it.
Right.
And I felt like the used car salesman of wine because I didn't know exactly what I was getting into. But you come to grow up with it and you love it. And so you want to foster that appreciation, the appreciation of place, the appreciation of where you're from. You want to give back to that community because, you know, you feel like you've gotten so much from it. And also, isn't it a cool thing to be in a spot that's untapped?
Mm-hmm.
Like you can look at all these other wine regions that have, you know, the legacies, and,
yep.
and you can be there and be part of it and to shape the conversation and to help the people who are along the way to see things a little differently, because maybe they don't have a WSET diploma, maybe they don't have a SOM certification, maybe they don't have, you know, the stress of having to rush out mains for table two because the amuse has already been cleared and they've been sitting for 5 minutes, you know, like it's I find that it's such a beautiful and fulfilling kind of a field to work in, to see all angles of it.
Yeah.
You love the art and you love being part of that creation process. So.
Yeah, we're going to end it there. I was going to ask you a question about transparency because it's all over the literature, but I love that answer. Let's see here. Let's be transparent even when wine ends up opaque. That is on the back of the label of the Cab Franc. That is a good quote. For people that want to find your wines, again, they can go to fourthwallwines.com. And I was on the website. Your wines are everywhere. Like I was looking at it. Every restaurant in Toronto or in the GTA or Southern Ontario of importance, your wines seem to find their way on all these lists.
I just like that people are supportive and sort of agree with the same principles of trying to make quality focused products that are high in character. And and thank you for having the chance to chat too. I mean, if nothing else, you know, even if it were just us sitting around and chatting, I think it's just so important to share, to taste, to enjoy, and to experience that together. Because you know, it's a social thing. You know, it's not about you know, trying to create a, you know, a high scoring wine. It's about trying to find the, you know, foster that appreciation for the region. So,
yeah. It's great. And listen, Joel, congrats on a very unorthodox way of making wine, of releasing your wine, of releasing your own expression of wines, working with all these great vineyards and winemakers. And from the portfolio, I've tried a bunch. It's a really impressive stuff. That's an expression of their terroir, as an expression of what the year and what the land is. So thanks so much for being a part of the podcast.
I appreciate you having me, Matt. Thanks so much.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Spotify, iTunes, Apple, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.